Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. We are joined today by the author and integrator Jeremy Lent and the chair of the Middle Way Society, the philosopher Robert M. Ellis. Jeremy was a recent guest on the podcast when he spoke to us about his book, The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. Shortly afterwards, Robert wrote a review of the book, and some of the themes and issues raised in that review will form the basis for the discussion today. Okay, well, a warm welcome back to both of you then to the Middle Way Society podcast. Nice to talk to you again, Jeremy.
Yeah, so happy to be here, Barry.
And you too, Robert.
Yes, thanks. It's great to be back.
Okay, well, Jeremy, perhaps you could start for any of the listeners now out there who are not familiar with the book, The Pattern Instinct. Could you just give us a brief overview of it?
Sure, absolutely, Barry. Basically, The Patterning Instinct looks at the way different cultures have sort of patterned meaning into the cosmos, all the way from early hunter-gatherer times to present day worldview. And so it looks at the sort of hunter-gatherer worldview. It looks at early agrarian civilizations. And then a big part of the book looks at the split between the predominant worldview that arose in the West, in Europe, that then became our sort of globalized worldview that we have today, and an East Asian way of making sense of the world that we mostly associate with traditional China. And one of the key themes of The Patterning Instinct is that these different worldviews leads to kind of cultural frames, and they're based on root metaphors. And that these root metaphors essentially leads to a constellation of values arising from them. And those values actually have been major drivers of history. So it kind of traces how the ways in which different cultures have made sense of the universe have actually shaped history all the way to the present day. And just to finish the sort of final chapters of the book, look a lot at how our modern civilization is driving us on an unsustainable path, and kind of focuses on some of the what are some of these underlying kind of faulty elements, if you will, of the current worldview that may be driving us into this path that we're on right now.
Okay, great. And Robert, could you also just give us a summary of the review that you wrote about the book a couple of months ago?
Okay, yes. Well, it's attempts, as I usually do, to be balanced in its review, so I want to give it a whole context that I did appreciate and enjoy the book. It's a very rich book with a lot of interesting stuff in it. And I'm very much in sympathy with its values as well. So there's a lot of systems theory in it and a lot of exploration of metaphor and language and so on. And new things that I found in it that are very interesting, like the exploration of Neo-Confucian philosophy. But there's also a large part of the review was exploring a vein of criticism, because I also found, well, what I took to be the main argument, maybe Jeremy can clarify this in some ways, but I found the argument unclear in some ways and weak in some ways. So and that all really hinges around the relationship between what Jeremy's just described as root metaphors in Eastern and Western culture and values. So I suppose that the crucial point seems to be how much root metaphors really shape our values, how much they have to shape our values. And obviously I expect we both agree that they shape our values to some extent. They provide a context to our values. It's how much shaping goes on. And for me, I guess I'd appreciate, you know, the metaphors have a huge effect on the ways that cultures and indeed individuals develop, but within those metaphors, you know, we can use metaphors in different ways to form different beliefs which use the same metaphors, and indeed within a given culture there are rival metaphors and rival beliefs that arise from them. So it seems to me there's quite a few options, and within any given culture, whether it's Chinese or Western or Greek or whatever culture, there are competing metaphors and different movements of thought, different cultural assumptions in different places. And so it's a very, very complex picture. So it's not very clear to me exactly how much Jeremy's claiming the differences between East and West and their history is necessarily formed by metaphor. And also, well, where that takes us. So I've, you know, what I'm very much looking for in a book like this is a practical outcome. You know, what should we do about it and how does this help us to go forward? And I didn't really find that very much from the book, although Jeremy has already told me that he's working on another one, which will do that more, so that would be good.
Okay, and Jeremy, what would your response be to that interpretation?
Yeah, sure. You know, I think that you raise a really interesting point, Robert, and the way I'd like to kind of begin responding to what you're saying is this concept of it being my sort of thesis of how metaphor drives values and how values drives history as being, I think you've called it, well, I know in the review a couple of times you call it a weak argument. And I have to confess, when I first read it, you know, my defenses went out, weak, what do you know? And all that kind of stuff. But then when I reread the review, you actually mention in the review a very important chapter in my book on what's known as the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. And for anybody who's listening who's not familiar with that, it's a hypothesis that was driven mostly by Benjamin Whorf in the 1930s, which became the predominant way of thinking about the effect of language on cultural thought for some decades. And basically the hypothesis was that the language we speak, the structure of the language we speak, determines the way we make sense of the world. And so he focused a lot on Indo-European language structure as being linear and distinction between subject, object, etc., and things like Hopi language that looked at tenses in different ways and all that stuff. And it was very influential. And then it got massively attacked in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and to the point that it became so discredited that a linguist could like lose their job if they actually sort of try to defend it. And then in recent years, it's kind of resurfaced in the form of what's called a weak, like if the original Sapir-Whorf hypothesis was called the strong hypothesis, which basically meant that language determines the way you can make sense of the world. That was kind of destroyed by, say, for example, somebody could show a Hopi Indian whose language didn't make a distinction between future, present, and past, and show that the Hopi Indian was perfectly capable of knowing that something happened in the future or the past, and say, well, so it just shows what a nonsensical theory that was. But then in recent 10 or 20 years, the approach has arrived and has become predominant now in linguistic thought of what's called the weak Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. And the weak hypothesis is not that the language determines how you're able to think, but it influences how you're likely to think. Yeah. So if you think of like the way language works is in terms of the neural channels or the neural pathways that get strengthened or weakened in our brains through the usage of particular words and structures of sentences, etc. The weak hypothesis says that, you know, you're more likely to, if your language has a word for something, you're more likely to think in terms of that word than if your language has no word for that kind of idea. You're more likely to just sort of pass through that in your neural pathways and focus on something else. So to come back to that, the reason I took this detour is it comes back to your argument, the point you made in the review about my argument being weak. And if we take the strong, weak distinction that I was just describing for Sapir-Whorf and apply it to my argument, I would wholeheartedly agree with you that it is actually a weak argument in that sense, that I'm not saying that the core metaphors we have and the worldviews we have determine how each of us or even how a whole culture actually acts. But I am saying that those core metaphors influence and sometimes quite strongly the ways in which individuals and cultures act, and that has shaped history. So the point about that is that for in every one of these ways, and I think there's real value in looking at some of these core sort of metaphors and looking at how they shape history and maybe exploring together what are the mainstream ideas and recognizing that there are exceptions to those. But even once we identify the exceptions, I think my argument is that if you look at what is predominant in a particular cultural complex, and you can actually relate that to how history has actually shaped and how individuals in a particular culture are likely to make sense of the world, recognizing that that's not predetermined.
Interesting. I mean, I very much I remarked on that chapter about the Sondheim Orth hypothesis in my review, and I very much appreciated it. And there's a very interesting example in that of this Aboriginal group who has a completely different sense of direction because of their language. It's a very striking example. But obviously, so that's a good example of a very specific way in which language does seem to have strongly shaped certainly particular aspects of people's experience. But on the whole, suppose we're coming back to words like likely and influence and predominant, and it's all a matter of degree, and now most things are. but the question is always, of course, how much, how likely is it that if you've got a particular metaphor that's predominant in your culture that you will think in that way, and how likely is it you might come across alternatives and think differently because of that alternatives, and so on. So, and I guess the Aboriginal example is probably more originally culturally homogeneous, at least in the original Aboriginal context before settlement, than complex Chinese or Western societies where there were lots of different intermingling influences. So if you just took the interaction between different sorts of Greek philosophy and Christian and Jewish influence and all the different kinds of metaphors and cognitive models that have mingled in the history of Western civilization. So it seems that the more complex the picture is from that point of view, the less likely it becomes that any particular metaphor or any particular model is going to be determinative of our ways of thinking. And I suppose my other point there would just be that if you want to argue that a particular metaphor has become predominant in a culture, then that's going to be prone to confirmation bias, which we're all subject to. But that was one thing I noted in your book, that you identified certain examples which illustrated your point. But very interestingly, you also showed others that didn't, that argued against it. I'm not sure you gave the counterexamples enough weight, or indeed discussed a lot of others which might have even more led to the questioning of your arguments. I suppose one example of that, which perhaps we could come onto, is the relationship to Christianity and Buddhism, which are largely neglected. Well, the original founders of those religions, Jesus and the Buddha, are largely neglected in your book, and they often seem to me to provide counter-arguments because they're both figures who challenged the predominant metaphors and predominant ways of thinking in their culture, introduced universal themes and ways of thinking. So in the process, they made the picture much more complex. They gave people more options, which was a crucially helpful thing to do, and thus reduced the likelihood, perhaps, that people would always think in a particular way in those contexts.
Sure, let's kind of explore some of that a little bit. What I'd like to do is just sort of touch on a couple of examples that I kind of focus on in the book about where, even though I talk about this notion that these sort of core metaphors influence and it's sort of weak in the way that we were just describing, I do think that they are hugely, hugely important. Let me give you a couple of themes, if you will, in the book that I think show that. So, I mean, to me, maybe one of the most obvious ones is this sense of substance dualism that arises in Western thought. And by substance dualism, basically what I mean specifically is this notion that the cosmos itself is divided into two different dimensions, which really don't even have any kind of overlap with each other. There's this kind of absolute transcendent dimension, and there's this kind of material dimension of the material world, which is kind of, which has a negative quality to it, like a polluted quality to it. And along with that, the human being itself is split similarly, so that we have like a soul and a body, and the soul somehow connects with this kind of transcendent realm, and the soul is actually imprisoned in the body, and the body is actually a negative influence. And so we see from the from sort of Plato through Christianity and all the way to after Descartes in modern worldview, split between mind and body, we see this kind of substance dualistic split. And what I found, I didn't start off with a presumption that that was true and then spend years of my life looking for examples to back that up. Quite the opposite. As I was sort of peeling the onion to understand how cultures worked, I was shocked and amazed as I read all these different generations of thought and ideas, how this one concept, no matter what happened, if you go from the ancient Greeks to Christianity, and then you go from Catholicism to Protestantism, and then you go to modern scientific thought, somehow it's so ingrained in the way of thinking that people couldn't even conceive of a difference. So you have someone like Descartes, whose his whole life's mission was to not be stuck on preconceptions. And his whole thing was, I'm going to like go to the very, very core of reality so I can throw out preconceptions and really understand reality. But he was so stuck in this dualistic way of thinking that what he ended up with, what he thought was this core foundation of being, I think, therefore I am, was basically like a restatement of even before Plato, some of the sort of early pre-Socratic thinkers who first came up with substance dualism, almost like a restatement of them saying, you know, you can't believe flesh, you cannot believe, only reason is the truth, yeah, or whatever. And then in the East, for example, one sort of core metaphor, if you will, is this notion of, rather than looking at the mind as being part of reason and located in the brain, in Chinese, the word xin basically means mind-heart. So there was this whole notion that it was unthinkable, basically, to consider some sort of split human being where there was some sort of reason separate from emotion, because when your mind heart had a feeling, you know, you could feel your heart pounding faster. And so it was like this absolute core notion that the mind was something that was embodied. So even though people could interpret these core metaphors in all kinds of different ways, leading to all kinds of different ways of making sense of the cosmos, that's an example in my mind of something that is rooted so deep in a cultural structure of thought that even the greatest minds in that culture would find themselves stuck in that, even when they thought they were breaking out of it.
Could I just try and clarify one central thing from what you've just said there, Jeremy? I mean, you talk about substance dualism as a core way of thinking, and you often seem to use terms like this, way of thinking or whatever. But substance dualism is a philosophy. I've studied it as a philosophy, and yeah, by Descartes and so on. But obviously that philosophy draws on certain metaphors, but it's a formalization of those metaphors in particular ways. And if you look at the whole population of Western civilization, very, very few of them actually read Descartes or appreciate his philosophy in any detail. So what would you see as the connection between that philosophy and the metaphors that you talk about?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And a lot of my book really tries to look at that. Like, how do these underlying sort of structures of belief that only a few people, like you say, in a culture might have done the writing, the thinking, and the core philosophical work, but how did that actually show itself in the lives of people and in the course of history? So, I mean, one powerful way in which this substance dualism affected hundreds of millions of Europeans throughout history, and then ultimately after colonialism, the whole world, was, for example, this belief that the body and acting on your bodily desires or whatever is a bad thing, and that you'll go to hell. And countless generations of millions of women have been sort of branded as their sexuality as being something bad because of, you know, arising from this kind of core dualistic thought of this kind of split between reason and emotion. I think, you know, there's untold countless stories of people, say, living in traditional Christian countries whose lives were profoundly affected by realizing they had a particular physical drives and being told that these were evil and wrong and they'd go to hell and they might act out on them and then be stricken with guilt and fear for their eternal soul going to hell after they died. And I mean, people's lives revolved around these mythic structures of thought. And I would argue that it was that happened in a very destructive way for, you know, untold countless generations of people.
I really do think you're blurring the boundaries here between these very formalized, intellectualized philosophies and structures of thought. Structures of thought are much more generalized things. And these specific philosophies that have been turned into metaphysical absolutes by people like Descartes, in my view, their effects are hugely overrated, really, because maybe the way in which they're absolutized has an effect, but the specifics, very few people know about them, and they're neither necessary nor sufficient to the kind of effects you're ascribing to them. So you're relating substance dualism, say, to not acting on your bodily desires, so which you could call asceticism. So you're suggesting a link between substance dualism and asceticism, but there were ascetics who were monists, you know, in ancient India. There's the people the Buddha tangled with and who want to crush their desires because they believe that leads to better karma. But that all happens within a monist framework, not a substance dualist one. And then there were lots of people in Western civilization who aren't substance dualists, who have a lot of the same sort of habits of thought, but it's not, you can't trace it to substance dualism. They don't even agree with Descartes. So I can't say I'm satisfied with those links you're trying to make at all.
Well, so let's look at each of those. One is, just to go back to what you're saying about the asceticism in ancient India. Well, as you may remember in my book, I actually trace substance dualism to this kind of core proto-Indo-European way of thinking. And in my book, you know, I have this chapter on traditional Indian thought, on Vedic thought, where I kind of explore, it's very confusing actually, because of course there's this predominant philosophy in India called Advaita, which actually means sort of not to. So it gives the impression that this is monism and different from substance dualism. But actually, what I sort of came to realize after really sort of investigating this, and again, I didn't go into this with a presumption that Indian thought was dualistic and trying to prove a point, but quite the opposite. I spent some number of years really quizzical about trying to understand where ancient Indian thought fit into this whole historical thought patterns. And to my shock, really, I realized, I began to discover at some point that they both had this core dualistic mindset. And so a lot of what we think of as monism in Vedic thought is actually another form of dualism, where there's this notion that sort of consciousness is all, if you will, or that Atman is Brahman, and Atman is our indivisible soul. And Atman is well translated as soul in English language. And that soul is each human being's sort of connection with the infinite. And if you look at descriptions of Brahman and the sort of infinite in the Upanishads, you'll see language that is so similar to some of the descriptions of pre-Socratic and Platonic writing. It's uncanny. And I spend a number of pages looking at these similarities. So I think that what would be more valuable to look at a counter-argument to what I'm saying is to look at East Asian thought. And obviously China is the biggest example of that, but you see, you know, there's Japan and Korea and other areas too, or indigenous thoughts in other parts of the world, and look for that kind of asceticism there. And again, to your point, there's always examples of counterexamples. I mean, you know, the world, thankfully, is filled with gazillions of people who have each one has their own unique way of making sense of things. But you'll notice that in traditional Chinese thought, there's actually very little asceticism. And when there's this kind of Taoist approach of sort of leaving the worldly things behind, it's a different kind of way. It's like it's about really connecting in a deeper, more meaningful physical way with the world. And it's a much more embodied way. And in fact, there's some really profound Taoist literature about how if you think too much, that's really bad for you. And how when you really connect with your inner spirit, it's about nourishing the spirit, just like nourishing the body. So it's a very different way of looking at things.
Okay, so let's move on to another core issue that you brought up in your review, Robert, the whole issue of meaning and belief. Both of you are actually very influenced by the work of George Lakoff and Mark Johnson on embodied meaning. But there were a couple of issues there. So could you perhaps give your view on that, Robert, and then, Jeremy, you can respond.
Sure. Okay, well, for me, the implication of Lakoff and Johnson's work is seems very clearly to be that the meaning is prior to belief. So meaning is embodied, which means that, well, it's gradually formed, particularly in infancy, from our embodied experiences, which create synaptic links, so you create a set of associations between basic meanings and associations with symbols or words which relate to those meanings. So hence you get basic categories and basic schemas which are formed in infancy, and then those get gradually extended through our lives through elaborations of metaphors. I mean, I think that's a wonderful theory with far-reaching effects. And a whole pile of, to me, very convincing evidence. Yeah, so the implication of that really is that we need to understand meaning in terms of our basic experience. So we find something meaningful in relation to our basic experience because our bodies find it meaningful. And that's the case at the level of metaphor as well. We appreciate a metaphor's meaning in relation to what our body tells us. And that all happens prior, as a prior condition of belief. So beliefs are much more abstract things. They're formed from cognitive models, which are created out of metaphors. So cognitive models give us a certain way of thinking, a certain set of assumptions within which we can formulate, you know, claims that we call our beliefs, whether those are implicit or explicit. So it seems to me very important to keep that distinction, and very often the language that Jeremy seems to use in his book, so whether he's talking about forms of thought or whatever, or ways of thinking, I think he's got a range of other terms like that, but they seem to blur that distinction, which to me is quite an important one. So constantly, as I read his book, I was wanting to ask, well, what is he talking about? Is he talking about relationship between meaning and these cultural changes in history? Or is he talking about people's beliefs? And he seemed to move a lot from one to the other. He moved from what the philosophers were saying, which were definitely beliefs, like substance dualism that we were just talking about. That's one kind of level of discussion, if you like. But then another level of discussion is the basic meanings that we appreciate with our bodies, which seem to me to be far more flexible. Which is why if he is talking at the level of meaning, then it's harder to sustain his thesis. But yeah, perhaps I'd better pass over to Jeremy at that point.
Yeah, sure. And I do think, you know, a core way that could be very valuable to look at the issues you raise is for us maybe to each think about, you know, how do we define these terms like meaning and belief? And how does that relate to this notion I describe in the book of the root metaphor? I'd like to thank you in terms of in the review that you wrote there, really caused me to really think about that maybe even more deeply than I had before in terms of how I would consider the relation between these things. So let me run a couple of definitions by you and see how you think about these, just so that we've got sort of some core shared ground, if you will, to then describe where we go beyond that. So I agree with you totally in terms of your interpretation of the Lakoff and Johnson understanding of metaphors and how that arises from our core embodied meaning. And I do think that as human beings, we start off with meaning being embodied as infants, and other things, you know, come from. And really, and something I describe in the book is how metaphor really is necessary. And this is a finding of Lakoff and Johnson, but metaphor is necessary for abstract thought. I mean, almost like all the words we use abstractly that we're just so used to using, we don't even think about. If you look at what those words actually come from, then metaphor. So just look at what I just said. If you look at, well, I'm not asking you to look at something right now, but I'm using that as a metaphor of seeing. So in all those aspects, and when I say in all those aspects, there's not an actual, you know, we don't, aspects are not a real container. But in every single abstract concept comes from these metaphors we use all the time. So that's just something that is so valuable, a great insight from Lakoff and Johnson. And so it begins with this embodied thing. So then what is a belief? Well, the way I would make sort of define belief really is like an implicit assumption that we make about what is true with or without empirical evidence. So a belief can be something that's based on empirical evidence. Like we believe the earth, the world is round, because we have empirical evidence. We've got all these pictures and all these things that work to based on that to show that. But of course, somebody can also believe that the world is flat, or they can believe that souls go to heaven after after death or whatever. So a belief is something that a person absolutely, their sense of what is true or not is based on that, and it may or may not relate to empirical evidence. And I think that if we then look at what a root metaphor is and how that relates to this notion of meaning and belief, I think a root metaphor can be a belief, but doesn't have to be a belief. For example, many people in our world today use a root metaphor of nature as a machine, which comes from the scientific revolution era and this powerful way of using science to view nature as if it were a machine. But people from Descartes to Richard Dawkins to regular people, reporters who write articles in any magazine today, oftentimes actually will go beyond that being a metaphor and say that is true. And I've spoken to really highly intelligent, educated people all the time who say nature is a machine. And they don't say it's a metaphor. They have a belief that nature is a machine. Yeah. Whereas I would argue that is fundamentally wrong. I mean, fundamental in that, really essentially wrong. It's the essence of that. It is a metaphor that can be very powerful and used in a very powerful way. But it's a metaphor, not a belief, not a truth, if you will. So that's where you can see this interesting diversion between belief and metaphor, because a scientist could say, look, I use in my daily thinking this metaphor of nature as a machine, and I splice genes and all based on that metaphor. But I know that's just a working metaphor. Or you can have other people who just see actually believe that nature is a machine. So that's kind of a little bit how I would look at some of those distinctions. But let me pause and see what you think about those distinctions, Robert.
Yeah, I'm all the way with you, really. All of those seem fine to me. I mean, I tend to try and avoid reference to truth or defining belief, but I think the way you used it is fine, really. And also, particularly, a root metaphor doesn't have to be a belief. Yeah, very much so. So metaphors give us a variety of options, and indeed metaphors can be interpreted in a variety of different ways. I mean, I think the example I gave in my review was, you know, nature is a resource, but you can interpret a resource either as a sort of bottomless pit, cornucopia, or you can interpret a resource as something you should be frugal with and be careful with. So there are a lot of different possible beliefs connected to a lot of metaphors, and yet I also agree with you that some metaphors are, well, I would call them absolutized, so like your example of Richard Dawkins, say, and they turn into absolute beliefs, certainly. So people have beliefs about the inevitability of certain metaphors. And when metaphors become absolutized, then you might as well talk of them as beliefs, and they have a negative effect of absolute beliefs.
Great. So following on then, Robert, from your point, I think a big theme of my book is that the metaphors that we use oftentimes without even realizing that they are metaphors in our culture do lead to real live deliverable, like actual activities, and they actually do lead to how history turns. Just to take your example right there about nature as a resource, and which I think if you look at the core metaphor that comes from, it's sort of basically nature as something that has no intrinsic value to itself, but is either a machine or a resource, or it's kind of it's this kind of thing without life that then can be used in one form or other. So if you take this kind of nature as a machine core metaphor, as you say, some people and many people in today's world interpret that is a, okay, let's use it for whatever we can. And then when you have things like how to deal with climate change, they'll take that metaphor and they'll say, well, we need to apply geoengineering techniques. You know, the earth is one big machine and it's kind of, we've like led to these imbalances. We need to rebalance it in that way. Or in a more positive way, it's a lot of people will look at the nature as resource metaphor, and a lot of environmentalists, really, really well-meaning and good people who see what's going on, they want to relate the fact that we're abusing nature to the capitalist mentality. And so they call, there's this whole big theme of ecosystem services, and we need to value this estuary here or this coral reef there, and they think if we can put a value on it and say this coral reef is worth $100 million, then we can show people they shouldn't pollute it. So that's a good thing to do, and people are doing that right now all around the world. And yet that sort of fits into this metaphor of nature as a resource, which then allows a corporation to say, okay, great, we got that. That coral reef is valued at $100 million. Well, this resort that we could build could be worth $500 million. So easy decision there. Whereas if you have a different root metaphor, such as nature as a living entity of intrinsic value, then it's not the whole concept of nature as a resource becomes irrelevant. It's like, what is there is intrinsic value to this thing that you, and as soon as you try to put money on it, you are losing that metaphor basically, and it leads to a very different way of thinking about how you might relate to environmental issues. So that's an example of how I think, and so somebody can look at nature as a resource with really good intentions and come up with good approaches, but I do think that you have to really recognize what that underlying metaphor can lead to. And I think that's one of the ways in which we can shift where we go in our futures by that kind of recognition.
Okay. I was just wondering, as you spoke there, as to whether your thesis could be clarified, at least in the terms that I would find clearer, that to absolutize metaphors have negative cultural effects. But then you went on again to talk about specific metaphors having specific effects, so obviously that seems not to be adequate. But you know, for me, still the problem that you sometimes, you know, put your finger on, but in a somewhat contingent way, is that absolutized metaphors have negative effects on cultures and what people do in them. But it's the absolutization that's the crucial thing, not what the metaphor is. So your other example of nature as intrinsic value. Okay, well, probably the negative effects of people believing that nature has intrinsic value are less obvious if you weigh it all up to nature as a mechanism in the history of humankind. But nevertheless, it's not at all difficult to imagine people who believe that nature has intrinsic value and create, you know, sort of whole set of holy wars based on it. You know, they're happy to fight for nature without any regard for the consequences. For instance, maybe there are some kind of extreme deep ecologists who are willing to, you know, in fact, there are some kind of eco-fascists, aren't there? There's that Finnish thinker, I can't remember his name now, but who actually believes that the best way to save nature is to destroy people. And so that's a possible way of thinking, which would absolutize a particular metaphor. So in a way, I agree with you about many of your examples, but I think I have a different view about why they're a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I hear you. And I think that's a core theme that I picked up in your review. And I'd love to explore that with you now more, because I agree with what you're saying completely. And so I'd like to maybe just sort of add my perspective on where you're going on that. And first off, it's true, even like right now, our world is so imbalanced in the sense that the nature is machine metaphor and conquering nature metaphor have become so predominant that it's causing these massive imbalances, potentially even leading to the destruction of our civilization and certainly the extinction of many species, etc. So in that sense, I think we need to rebalance by reemphasizing some of these other metaphors that have been lost in mainstream thinking. But I could easily imagine a world like if we were to imagine some, you know, say the collapse of our civilization and say some new civilization arose based only on this belief that nature has intrinsic value. And you can imagine somebody trying to develop technology to understand, to rediscover things like antibiotics or whatever. And they would want to do experiments. And people say, no, you're not allowed to do that experiment. Nature has an intrinsic value and you shouldn't take this animal and try killing it to see what happens because, you know, and you'd never have any technological progress under that kind of scenario. So I'm with you 100% on the risk of absolute metaphors, you know, and losing that kind of balance. So having said that, I think that what I would really say that I'm actually trying to accomplish in my book itself is to put into practice the very thing that you're talking about. Essentially, like most of us in the West or in the modern world today, live according to a worldview without realization that there even is a worldview. And that's, and not just, I'm not saying not just our modern culture, but in cultures in general, it's a little like fish swimming in water, you know, and they might be aware of currents and the seaweed and other things, but they're not aware of water because that is what they're living in. And I think that people live in their worldviews in a similar way. And part of what I'm trying to do in the book is to actually help people in our modern world to recognize that the way in which we see things in today's world is not a sort of preconditioned and, in fact, actually comes from specific ideas that arose in specific times and place historically that some of them are just blatantly wrong. But have become so much part of our way of thinking that we just accept them without thinking, and that there are other alternative ways of thinking. Not that those other ways of thinking are better than and that we have a bad way of thinking, but that by offering these different ways of making sense of the world, it kind of is an invitation to the reader to really think for themselves, oh, what do I think about that I'm not examining? And when it's a concept that I sometimes I call cultural mindfulness. So just like if we try to teach mindfulness to people in terms of their own beliefs, and as you're sitting there in meditation, you might, you know, have a thought, and then as you get practice in meditation, you might get to this point of going, oh, I recognize that's a belief that I have about so-and-so said that to me, and it's not necessarily true, but I'm going on as if it's a belief, and I need to hold that and recognize that and look at other possibilities. So similarly, a cultural mindfulness would be to look at the very things that we take for granted in our culture and get to that same recognition of, you know, really asking if those are, where do they actually come from? And are there other ways of making sense of the world that could lead to different outcomes?
Mm. Yeah, well, I'd see that as an application of critical thinking. Also the underlying sort of principle of skepticism that, you know, where skepticism is used in a balanced way, a total way rather than a selective way, where, you know, you become aware of the limitations of any particular view by applying a skeptical argument. So it gives you more options and you can make better use of those options with more awareness of them and their implications and the way that they apply to your particular context. Yeah, so, I mean, if that's the goal, and I'm certainly with you there, but I guess I don't see that as the emphasis in your book, which seems to be much more about putting forward specific metaphors as better than others and making a contrast between cultures.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting that you interpret what I write in the book as saying that some metaphors are better than others. And it may be that I didn't emphasize that enough, but I do think there are some places in my book where I'm very, very explicit about that in terms of that not being the case, where, you know, I talk about, I think in that chapter we were describing earlier, just looking at the difference between East Asian and Western mindsets, how culture shapes our way of thinking. I think I've got a paragraph towards the end where I say very explicitly, this should not be interpreted as saying that somehow Eastern ways of thinking are better than Western. And I, you know, to your point earlier, I give examples of how, for all their emphasis on harmonizing with nature, some of the worst ecological disasters in all of human history occurred in China, with the destruction of the forests and the flooding of the Yangtze and all kinds of horrendous stuff. And I think I'm quite explicit about saying that what the invitation is to recognize that there are different ways of thinking, and that if we look at how history has developed over the last few hundred years, the Western way of thinking has become very, very dominant through the world. And that way of thinking has brought all these wonderful things that I'm as grateful for as anybody else. Technology, the ability for us to talk across continents and in a podcast like this, and untold wonderful advantages. And it's leading us to this imbalance that risks actually losing all of these things because of our civilization is really teetering, in my view, on the brink of potential collapse if we don't change the direction it's going in, not to mention some of the destruction that is wrought on the natural world. And I would argue some of the extreme exploitation of other human beings that we see in the world today. That's more of a question argument, because we see exploitation all through the world. But I do, in one of my chapters, I do explore how exploitation, ever since the rise of agriculture, has been sort of worldwide. But there's something about the Western way of being prepared to disrupt traditional ways of equilibrium that has led to exploitation going to extremes that I think were unthinkable in other times.
One of the things you do in your review, Robert, is suggest that whilst you have a common agreement about the issues that Jeremy brings up, you suggest that maybe it's due more, not so much due to a difference in culture, but generally people tend to think in absolute ways, and that you suggest that if people could cultivate a way of judging things more provisionally, that would be a better approach. Maybe you could expand on that a little bit, and then Jeremy could respond.
Sure. Well, yeah, I guess a lot of the things that Jeremy discusses in cultural terms, which are, you know, they're very debatable in these cultural contexts and complex and so on, to me, those often seem to be human problems. You know, so they arise particularly from, you know, the geography of our brains and the way in which the functions that we have as humans. So particularly absolutization as a function of the overdominant left hemisphere, which Ian McGilchrist identifies pretty well, I think. So there's a basic problem there that's going to apply to anybody's interpretation of metaphors or beliefs, wherever they are, in whatever culture they're situated. You know, those cultures or beliefs that they come across may be just seen as the whole story, and anything that is an alternative to it may just be seen as a threat, as a negation of that belief that they hold. Or alternatively, if they've developed sufficiently and are aware of the possibility of a critical process, then they can start looking at those beliefs in relation to others, so they've got options, so they can weigh them up, and that requires a wider set of relationships, so that the we're not just concentrating on an overdominant left hemisphere, left prefrontal cortex, but we're also having not sufficient connections to meaning in the right hemisphere, which offers us other ways in. So if that's an overall human problem, that, you know, I'm very happy to kind of apply that observation about humans to any particular cultural situation where it's going to apply. I guess it seems to me more important to do it that way round than to go from the cultural to the human in general. Mm. Yeah, let Jeremy come back on that.
Yeah, sure. And just kind of building on what you're saying, I do think that, you know, the work of Ian McGilchrist in recognizing the left hemisphere dominance is so important. And in my book, I focus on the sort of the prefrontal cortex itself rather than the left-right split. You know, although in a way there, it's almost like looking at each of those splits really looks at the same thing. Because when I'm talking about the PFC dominance, it's that symbolic thinking and conceptualization, a lot of which comes from our left hemisphere that I'm talking about. And in fact, when I was in early drafts of my book, before it was called The Patterning Instinct, I actually was calling my book The Tyranny of the Prefrontal Cortex. And so very, very similar to that sort of Ian McGilchrist understanding of how, but I was, again, focusing on the PFC, but it's really the left hemisphere of the PFC that we're talking about there. So I'm very much with you on that. And if we think of actually the title I did settle on, The Patterning Instinct, it's part of what I try to look at in the book is, as if you think about what a pattern actually is. A pattern is sort of what emerges from two functions. One is we make meaningful connections between different points that otherwise would be sort of random or unspecified, and we ignore certain other random points that we choose not to make meaningful connections in. So a pattern, so if you look at the stars, like the perfect example is constellations. Every culture in history has looked up at the stars and has been driven by that patterning instinct to put constellations into it. And when you do that, you say, okay, those are important, and that relates to something, and the other ones we'll kind of ignore. And I think that when we're looking at the very issue you're talking about, Robert, in terms of the human predilection to focus on some things and then ignore others, it's that patterning instinct that does that. Once we form a pattern, which essentially a pattern of meaning essentially becomes our worldview, things that don't fit in that worldview, well, we tend to either ignore them completely as if they're not even there, or we tend to go through motivated reasoning to rationalize why actually they don't really mean what they seem to mean, or they actually do fit in with our worldview after all, and we'll go through all kinds of, I mean, a little bit like these amazing things that the early Western and Greek and early European astronomers used to do when they when their worldview determined that the Earth, that the stars were fixed, were part of this eternal domain, and they had to try to figure out why do the planets not fit according to that same criteria. Ptolemy came up with these incredibly complex ways of coming up with something that could save the model, if you will, of that worldview. And I do think that that is something that we do as humans all the time. And again, I sort of offer my book really as an invitation to help people go through not just this process of our own internal mindfulness that allows us to look at those ways that absolutized thinking can affect our own daily lives, but as this form of cultural mindfulness to recognize that beyond our own ways of thinking, our culture's ways of thinking can be questioned in the same kind of way.
Okay, I just want to distinguish between two levels of what you're talking about, which in relation to meaning and belief that we talked about earlier, because I would say that this kind of process of selection operates at the meaning level, the things that we don't find meaningful because we haven't got even weak connections by which to engage with them. But then there are also things that we understand, at least to some extent, but don't believe. So at one level, you can have incomprehension, you know, because we don't speak the language, or we don't, we're unable to engage in some way. But at the other, we've got, you know, ad hoc rationalization and people finding reasons not to engage with something that they conceivably could understand make use of. So I guess, and that distinction seems important to me because it can be tackled in different ways. So I talk about integration of meaning and integration of belief. So integration of meaning can be addressed more through the arts, for example, by expanding our imaginations or by our experience of other cultures. So maybe that fits more with what you talk about as cultural mindfulness. But the other level of dealing with belief is much more, can be much more directly tackled through critical thinking, through a more explicitly cognitive process. And obviously the two interrelate, but I suppose this comes back to the debate we were having earlier about, you know, with the distinction between meaning and belief and how it might be important.
Yes, I know. It's interesting. I've struggled for a while now with this notion of what do I mean by meaning? I mean, a lot of what I write about is in relation to meaning, how cultures have patterned meaning into the world. And in fact, my next book, the working title is The Web of Meaning, sort of integrating science and traditional wisdom to find our place in the universe. So meaning is very meaningful to me. And then what is it? And I have come to think of meaning as being really a function of connectivity, as really, like when we look at the simple way, when we say something like, what does a word mean? We look it up in the dictionary, and the dictionary tells us it relates to these other words. It uses other words to tell us about this word. And ultimately, it comes back to the whole Lakoffian thing. Ultimately, even if you didn't have words, you know what warm and cold is because you feel it. You know what up and down is because you feel it. So there are these core embodied, almost like the core of meaning is that embodied experience. And then all meaning really arises in terms of connectivity from those core embodied lived experiences that we as human animals have. Then meaning gets to be a function, in my view, a function of connectivity. And the more things have meaning in somebody's life, the more they are connected with other things in their life. And so when somebody feels like life is meaningless, what they're essentially feeling, I think, is they're not feeling connected either with their community or with other parts of what it is to be alive in the world. So life becomes meaningless because of that lack of connectivity. And then it seems to me that what it really – and I love that term integration also that you use a lot. And to my mind – meaning and integration relate a lot to each other because things can be connected in ways that are not that meaningful too. Like, so for example, if you think of just ice forming, each ice crystal is firmly connected with all the other ice, but in a very straightforward and simple way that doesn't have a ton of meaning around it. Whereas integration, to my mind, is a sense of unity with differentiation. There's ways in which things can be connected and you can recognize their differences and also recognize their connectivity and their unity at the same time. And I think one of the best things that we can do in our own practices to and sort of connect with meaning is to explore what that integration means in terms of our own lived experience and our cultural awareness too. So I don't know how that relates to your way of thinking, Robert. Just wanted to share that with you.
Yeah, no, it relates very much to my way of thinking. I suppose just the point I was trying to put across there is particularly that we need to be able to work at both levels. There is this kind of cultural stroke artistic way of working, which is just about becoming aware of alternative ways of thinking. And then there's a much more philosophical way of working, really, which is more about examining beliefs and their justification. Those seem to me to be, they need each other, they feed into each other. But yes. We can't assume that one necessarily implies the other at any particular point.
Yes, I think that's true. And the one thing I would add to that is that I think it's so important to look at integrating what we come to through rational critical thinking and rational investigation, and what we come to through our own embodied experience of the world, to get back to that Lakoffian issue. Because, again, to me, the great example is Descartes, who, you know, was clearly one of the world's greatest critical thinkers, who just absolutely, his whole life's mission was about that. And yet, because he was stuck in one sort of cultural milieu, he could only come, what he thought was the sort of ground of being was as clearly, well, it can be clearly seen as this sort of fundamental error or whatever. And or we can also, if we get too stuck in our intellectual critical thinking, we do oftentimes end up in places that don't integrate with our embodied sense. So my point is that I think through mindfulness techniques and embodied practices, it helps to really be connected with what our bodies and our emotions and our feelings are telling us, and to integrate that into our rationalizations of things and our sort of our intellectual activity, and not be too much stuck in one plane rather than both at the same time.
That brings to me to my last question, actually, because it's interesting what you were saying about Descartes there, one of the world's greatest critical thinkers. But I brought this up in a few podcasts. There was a study a couple of years ago by this guy called Dan Kahan, who did this research which strongly suggested that intelligence and education are actually no real safeguard against blinkered thinking. What seems crucial is curiosity and an openness to being wrong. Now, a big part of both of your work is this idea of practice, to be able to be open and be curious. And you both of you talk about integrations and integrative practices. So how can those practices help you to be less blinkered?
Yes, great question. Robert, do you want to start off?
Well, I feel a relatively short answer. I could say a lot about this, but can help us by providing alternative options, which is a thing we've been talking about, by broadening our awareness. So whether we're talking about practices like meditation or the arts or critical thinking, any of those levels of working, these can help to make us aware of alternatives to what we've otherwise been assuming. And therefore, when a new kind of challenge comes our way, or a new environment or something, a new condition, we're in a better position to deal with it more adequately because we've got a better repertoire of possible ways of understanding it.
Yes. And just to add to that, you know, I would totally agree with this lack of correlation between level of education and sort of open-mindedness. And, you know, you see this, all these studies, I don't know if he was referring to these studies, but on climate change, people who are deniers of climate change, you know, the more educated they are, the more vehemently they'll use their education to deny climate change. And so it gets this whole issue that how do you reach people with different views if you can't actually reach them through reason? And there's this, you're probably familiar with Jonathan Haidt and some of his work on understanding, you know, emotion and reason, and you know, his whole sort of thesis, which I think is so powerful, is like that really a lot of the time, or most of the time, we use in when we're forming value judgments or ethical or moral judgments, we form them implicitly, and then we use our reason almost like the lawyer rather than a judge. The reason becomes like the lawyer to advocate as to why we're actually feeling in that way, rather than as the path to actually come to a greater degree of understanding. And so to answer your question, my view is that one of the most important things we can do is practice compassion, and compassion and a sense of connectivity within ourselves and with others. So if I as a person feel hurt by something that comes at me, I think compassion plus inquiry will look at, you know, oh, why did I feel hurt? And without the compassion, you get really hard and you don't want to sort of go further. But if you can be soft with yourself and recognize that, then the inquiry can allow, oh, I got hurt because this affected my core sense of identity in terms of this or that, or this made me feel bad about this. And so having got to that place, it allows you to then move on from there. Mm-hmm. And similarly, I think in terms of if we're trying to reach out to others or engage in generative dialogue, which I hope that what we've been engaging in today is as an example of that, is to always look at the deeper layers of shared values or shared human instinct or even core natural shared realities. So going back to that Lakoffian model that we're both very comfortable with, somebody might, you know, here in the United States, somebody might be a Republican, a Trump supporter or whatever they might be. And it can be very difficult for me and many others like me to, you know, go, how do we even find that shared ground? But then when you actually talk with someone in that place, and you can go at a deeper level of place of compassion and sharing with what is it that is hard, what is it that makes you feel angry, and what is it that makes you feel bad? And if you're able to get to that place, you can actually find a place of shared humanity. And it's only from that place, I think, that we can then build places of connection and then hopefully at some point, you know, get to dissolve some of those barriers between us through that. So that's, I think, compassion practice, I think, is a key element of that, along with real open inquiry.
Mm-hmm. And any final thoughts, Robert?
Yeah, I agree entirely. I mean, I see compassion very much as the emotional aspect of awareness. It's another aspect of the awareness we've been talking about, really. It, you know, it has a relatively more emotive and a relatively more cognitive side to it, and those two constantly interdependent, so we can't neglect one to the total expense of the other.
Okay, and any final thoughts from you, Jeremy, for winding this up?
My only final thought is just I'd like to thank you both so much, and really thanks to you, Robert, for writing that review that you did write, and it clearly took a long, you know, lot of thought and care to put all the kind of thinking and critiques together in that article. And it did a lot for me. And it caused me to go through these layers of thinking that I was describing earlier, being hurt at some places and then trying to do the very processes that I'm talking about of looking at, oh, why did I feel hurt and what does that mean? And where are those places where we share our understanding so we can then use that to look at our differences to really gain from each other's perspective, and ultimately, you know, hopefully people listening to this conversation gain a broader view of the different ways of looking at these core issues that I think we both share our sense of the importance of. So thank you for taking the time to do that and for us having this process today, and to you, Barry, for facilitating it and making it happen.
And thank you for writing the book in the first place, which stimulated the whole process.
Okay, well, it's been for me an absolutely fascinating conversation, and I normally do quite a bit of editing, but I just found that this conversation so rich I'm going to really struggle. Anyway, thank you very much, the pair of you, for talking today.
Yeah, absolutely, it was a real pleasure. I'm glad that this took place. It's super that it happened.
Great, okay. Thank you.
You can find out more about Middleway Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.